Well, this is the time of the year when we in the Church of God form our own versions of what some people call New Year's resolutions. This is the beginning of the year, that time of the beginning of the year according to God's sacred calendar. And the spiritual instructions regarding the observances of these times require self-examination. And in the process of self-examination, that makes us think of things that we want to do differently, things we want to change, things we want to overcome, how we want to do better in life to reflect the life of Jesus Christ and the way that God the Father would have us live. So, preparing for this, what kind of changes would you like for the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread to produce in your life this year? If one is to grow and to change spiritually, we can't be like people who get on the momentary bandwagon of New Year's resolutions. They say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to lose 100 pounds, I'm going to, you know, do whatever I have to do this or accomplish that. And they start with great intentions, and then they just sort of fizzle out after a few weeks. What you find in people who do grow and change spiritually is something different. Not necessarily in their initial desire to make changes, because a lot of humans want to make changes in life. But what you find is something that's at the very core of their motivation. Something that runs deeper in motivation. Motivation is what drives human beings to do anything. We don't do things unless we want to do them, unless we are motivated to do something. Something drives us to do whatever we're going to do. And if the motivation is strong, if it's deep, if it's lasting, especially for us, if it's spiritual, that is when change is produced. That's what keeps a person going back and going back and going back to doggedly tackle whatever it is that they want to change. So what kind of changes would you like the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread to produce in your life this year? That is a very personal question. That is an extremely personal question, and that's a question nobody else can answer for you. But what we can look at together today is what we do have in common. We may all differ on things that we are looking at in terms of our personal lives that we're going to be working on. But what we have in common has to do with this issue of motivation. What is the core motivation for a Christian? What is it that drives you as a Christian? We're going to illustrate this through the account of something that happened at a very interesting dinner that Jesus was invited to. This was not the night to be much observed, but I'm sure that it was a night that everybody there observed a lot of things. It had to do with many things that were going on that were bound to produce, a lot of thoughts, a lot of things for them to consider that would weigh on their minds for a long, long time. But before we go to that account of that dinner, I want to first have us take a look at what the Days of Unleavened Bread are all about. And let's do that by looking at a scripture that doesn't even mention the Days of Unleavened Bread. But if we know the meaning of it, it is very clear that this talks about it. It's found in Colossians. In Colossians chapter 3. Colossians 3, and beginning in verse 1, Paul wrote to the church here at Colossae. And he said, If then you were raised with Christ, what does that mean? Well, it means if you were baptized. Goes through this, as you read the context, if you go all the way back into chapter 2. If you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above. So the whole thing of seeking something which is above has to do with this concept of being raised with Christ, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth, for you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. I didn't say this to Sonia last Sunday morning, but there have been times at baptisms that I walk into the house and see somebody there who's getting ready to be baptized, and I'll say, it's a good day to die, isn't it? Because that is what we're doing. We are going into that watery grave and the old man is being put to death. It is being buried. If you'll notice, just keep your finger here in Colossians 3 and go back to chapter 2 though. And verse 11. And this is what I was referring to in the opening comments about the Passover. In him you were also circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the sins of the flesh, by the circumcision of Christ, buried with him in baptism, in which you also were raised with him through faith in the working of God who raised him from the dead. And just like it goes through in Romans 6, as Christ was raised from the dead, even so we walk in newness of life. This baptism pictures our death, burial, and resurrection. We don't come to a resurrection as a spirit being like he did, but we are resurrected to walk a spiritual life from that moment on. And we have been raised with him. So back in chapter 3 and verse 3, when he said, "You died and your life is hidden with Christ in God," that's a reference back to what we went through at our commitment at baptism. And verse 4, this is what we look forward to. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. Therefore, anytime you see the word therefore, it means in light of what has just been said, here's a conclusion. Now what he's going to say has to do with the whole purpose of unleavened bread, the meaning of unleavened bread. But it is because we've been raised with Christ, we're seeking those things which are above, we died, and we're looking forward to the future. We understand this whole plan of God now. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth. Fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you also once walked when you lived in them. But now you must also put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, and filthy language out of your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds. So, this is just a short list. We can add other things too, the works of the flesh. But Paul is putting out here some examples. So when I ask at the beginning, what changes do we want it to make? Somewhere in there, we look at our lives and you say, I need to tighten up in this area. I need to do better in this area. I want to overcome in these things. Verse 10, and having put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge, according to the image of him who created him, where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised nor uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave nor free. Doesn't matter where we came from. Doesn't matter our background. Christ is all in all. And then he switches gears a little bit. Therefore, there that is again. As the elect of God, holy and beloved. Now he gave a list of things to put off. And in verse 8 it says, you must also put off these things. That's the leaven to put out. But then he says in verse 12, put on these things. This is the unleavened bread to take in. Tender mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, does that ever happen? Without elaboration, sure it does. And then he says, even as Christ forgave you, you also must do. So our behavior, the way we act, the way we view others, the way everything that is about our lives goes into what was done for us. Holy and beloved, elect of God, as we were forgiven, so we must also do. And then in verse 14, but above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. Love is the glue. That's the big one. You can read much about this in the rest of the Bible. In 1 Corinthians 13, at the end, it said, now there abides faith. How important is faith? Hope. What does hope do for us? And love. And it says, but the greatest of these is love. We're going to see a little bit about that today. This is the bond of perfection. It is the glue that holds us close to God. It is the key ingredient for being properly motivated. But how do we put it on? How does it come? How do you recognize it? How is it manifested? To grow, we have to be properly motivated. But how does one become properly motivated? What is it that stirs someone? How does one properly learn to love? Well, we're going to learn more about this today, and we're going to see that our capacity to love is directly tied to the meaning of the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. And now it's time to go to this story. And this is reflected, this lesson is found in this story in Luke 7. Luke chapter 7. We will begin in verse 36. Luke 7:36. Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. Now you're asked out to go to dinner at the Pharisee's home. Are you going to go? You going to take the invitation to go eat dinner at the Pharisee's house? Well, he did. He went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. Now, we might ask a question. Simon was a Pharisee. We'll see later his name was Simon. The Pharisees meant the separated ones. These were the people who were separated. These were the really, really religious people. Why would such a man even invite Jesus into his house to have dinner? And why would he go? Why would Jesus go? Well, there may be several reasons. You might say, well, maybe he just was a sympathizer. Maybe he admired Christ for everything that was going on. Not all the Pharisees were Jesus' enemies. Nicodemus came in the night. He was a Pharisee. I think I mentioned that a couple of sermons ago. But actually, just a few chapters over, you can just jot down this note. Luke 13:31 it is. There's a statement made here. On that very day, some Pharisees came saying to him, "Get out and depart from here, for Herod wants to kill you." It was Pharisees that came and said, "Hey, you need to take care of yourself." Not all the Pharisees were enemies. So maybe he just admired and respect Christ. But that's a little skeptical, because when you read the story, as we will, he treated him somewhat rudely. He wasn't exactly the most courteous to him, which you would think he would be if he admired him. Maybe he was trying, like some of the Pharisees did, to entice him into a situation where he could trick him. Maybe he had his plan of a conversation where he was going to try to lure Christ into making some mistake. Who knows? It doesn't really say that. Doesn't totally seem likely. He did call him teacher or rabbi later on here, which was a term of a little more respect. So I don't know, that maybe that's a reason. Maybe this Simon was just a celebrity chaser. You know, maybe he heard about this young guy in town, and he might have been a little patronizing even toward him. But maybe he said, you know, I want to check this guy out and see what he's all about. And I'll have a bunch of friends over, and we'll have him come in. Talk to with him. Maybe they thought they might be entertained a little bit by the new kid in town, you know, the one who was causing all the stir. Who knows exactly? It is hard to understand. Maybe he was just curious. Maybe he was really trying to figure something out here. We don't know for sure, but what we do know is that this was coming on the heels of Jesus being criticized for going out and eating with other people. If you read in verse 34, one of the criticisms of Jesus was that he came eating and drinking, and you say, look, a glutton and a wine bibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. So at least one thing he was going to show was that he could eat dinner with the Pharisees too. For those who might have been judging him and criticizing him, he was going to sit down and eat with them. Why would Jesus be a friend and eat with tax collectors and sinners? Why would he do that? Because he was always trying to help people. Always. When you read of these accounts, he had messages for them, he was talking to them, he was always trying to help. Was it going to be any different with the Pharisee? When he would go to have dinner with the Pharisee, his motivation was going to be exactly the same. He was going to be going there trying to help this individual, this man, Simon. He was hoping to do them good. His motivation was always that way. So for whatever reason, Simon was asking him to come into dinner. We know the reason Jesus accepted. Same reason he always interacted with people, hoping to do them well. As we go through this story, I'd like you to keep your eye on something that we may not normally think about. Usually the focus is on the lady that's going to come into the picture here. But notice who he is trying to help the most. As we go through here, think about who is he trying to help the most? Who does he have to direct most of his teaching toward? You're going to see that it's actually going to be on the Pharisee. Why was he so concerned about the Pharisee? Why was he trying to help him as well? Let's go on. Let's read more through here. Verse 37, "Behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner. When she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil." Now you might ask, well, how does this happen? A woman in the city who is a sinner. How does she just come into somebody's house? Well, part of this comes from knowing the customs of the time. The houses of well-to-do people back at that time were often built around an open courtyard. And in fact, you can still see them. One of the intriguing things, if you ever get to go to the feast in Guatemala, it's held in an old city of Antigua. And you walk the sidewalks, and you have the sidewalk, and there are no yards. They're just walls. And at first I was wondering, why would they have it like this? And they're beautifully painted, bright colors, and the doors. It is a city of... There's an entire book I found of just pictures of doors in the city, because people went through a lot of care to make beautiful doors. But one day I was walking along the city, and there was a door open, and you could see into the area, and it was like that. You saw through a hallway that was dark, and then it opened up into a courtyard in the middle. Then I found out later that's how most of them were built. Sort of a square with an open courtyard. And I thought, you know, in a space where size is, the lots that is available is somewhat limited, it's a very clever way. It's very private. But what was done back then was somewhat similar to that. Often in the courtyard, there was a garden, a fountain. And in the warm weather, that's where people tended to have their meals. Just like we do. You know, we'll go out on the patio instead in the summertime when the weather's nice. But it was also tradition, especially in the homes of the well-to-do, that all kinds of people came in and they were free to do so. And maybe there was some attention given to this particular dinner of having a somewhat of a celebrity, if you will, come for dinner, and people could come in and they could listen to the conversation. And that's probably why the woman was simply on the scene. She just came in. It was not necessarily unusual. What was a bit unusual is that this woman was a sinner. Inserting these words in here, and you can say, well, everybody's a sinner. Why point this out? Well, the language here, the way it is written, indicates that she was a notoriously bad woman. She was known to be a sinner. There are commentaries that say that she was probably a prostitute. But she was known to be a sinner. Why would she come? Why would she come in there? When she knew Jesus sat at the table. She was coming there specifically, obviously, to see him. What would motivate her to be there? We come to verse 38. She stood at his feet behind him, weeping.
That may tell you something about her presence. Why would she be standing there, come in, and be weeping? What had she heard? What had she seen? Had she been present? Was she at the edge of a crowd when he was talking on occasion? Had she seen some things? What had gone on in her life? It simply doesn't tell us. But people don't do these things unless they are motivated for some reason. Something brought her there. And she had seen it. She had heard it. Something had gotten to her. And so she brought this alabaster flask. That was very costly. And she stood at his feet behind him, weeping. Now, the custom at the time was when you would go in to someone's home, you would recline. We didn't gather chairs around the dining room table as we do now. It was custom of many people, not just the Jewish people, but in the Middle East. And in certain Bedouin societies today, it's still like that. You recline. Oftentimes, people would lean on their left elbow and they would eat with their right. And they would be lying, with their feet pointed behind them, everybody pointed in toward the middle, and they would be conversing with one another. And the servants, there was a space between where the feet was and the walls, and the servants would go around behind people. And that's where the expression came from of standing at the feet of someone. The servants would be behind everybody, standing at the feet, waiting to help them, standing there to serve them. And in this situation, she comes and stood at his feet behind him. That's why it says that. She stood at his feet behind him because he was lying there recumbent and his feet pointed to the back, as was the custom. And as she stood there weeping, she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil. What was she weeping for? Why? Why was she weeping? For what? At the end of this account, he's going to say something to her that is profoundly important because it gives us the reason why she was weeping. It doesn't tell us everything that she was saying. It doesn't tell us if there was conversation at all. But at the end of the story, he tells her, "Your sins are forgiven." She was weeping. She was there because of her sinful state. It was custom to have long hair. It was the usual custom. It was the ornament. It was the pride of a woman, if you will, not in a bad way. Great care would be taken with her hair. And now she is using her hair as a towel and crying and washing his feet with her tears. Again, what would motivate somebody to weep that hard, to cry so many tears? You're looking at this woman and you think, this is genuine. This is genuine. You know, sometimes you'll see an actor in the movies and they'll cry real tears and you think, man, they have to really concentrate and work themselves up to do that. That's not easy to act that way. There was no acting going on here. There was something deep enough that she had a flow of tears. What had she seen? What had she heard? What touched her? What got to her that deeply? At the Passover, every year we have foot washing. Have you ever been moved so much that you didn't need a basin of water to wash somebody's feet? Have you ever been moved at the foot washing so much that you would say, I have sufficient tears to do this? I haven't. This is somebody who is deeply, deeply stricken somehow. Have you ever been moved in the privacy of your prayer with God, though? Have you ever been moved to tears? I'm sure you have. We can be moved. It's seldom in public. But the Colossians 2 and 3 that we read, that depth of experience is a very moving thing to go through. So there she is. Now, this is a remarkable event, but what is also remarkable is what's going on in everybody's minds. There's a story here of things that are happening. And I know we've all been in this situation too. You're in a situation with people. Everybody is watching the same event, but drawing very different conclusions about it. Everybody's seeing it very differently. And then you go back and compare notes and you think, boy, you were seeing that very differently from what I was. Here is a situation. She didn't care what other people were thinking. Obviously, her thoughts were focused on Jesus Christ and what was going on. And she had in her mind certain thoughts, but other people didn't have the same thoughts. Verse 39, when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, this man, he's watching all this and he's thinking this through and he's saying, this man, if he were a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. Now, he was drawing a conclusion not only about what the woman was doing, but he was drawing, more importantly, a conclusion about Christ. Maybe he had come to that dinner, invited Christ to that dinner, trying to find out what's really going on with this man. But now he comes to the conclusion, if he were a prophet, he's concluding he isn't. Because he was giving Jesus the litmus test that he understood of defining what prophets were. He would have said he would have known her personally. He would see who she was. He would know her, and he would also know what she was. Otherwise, he would not be allowing her to do this. He would not allow her to have that familiarity with him. And he jumps to the conclusion he cannot be a prophet. Why would he jump to that conclusion? Because it was common in the Pharisaical world to have certain standards and certain tests for what was going to be a prophet. The Pharisees were looking for the Messiah. All the Jews were looking for the Messiah. Certain ones of them had certain signs that they had developed over a period of time. One of the things that the Pharisees looked to was that when the Messiah would come, that he would be quick of understanding. They based that on Isaiah 11 and verse 3. If you want to turn there, you can, but I'll read it for you real quick. It's a common prophecy that you've probably read this numerous times, but not known how they interpret it. Isaiah 11:3 says, his delight is in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears. Now, the word, it's translated very differently. If you have an Old King James or New King James, it's quite different. The New King James that I just read said, his delight is in the fear of the Lord. The Old King James says, he will be of quick understanding in the fear of the Lord. The word understanding in the Hebrew, literally translated, means smell or breathe. He'll be quick to sniff something out, in other words. It didn't mean that literally he could smell quick, but figuratively they said, the Messiah will be able to very quickly sniff out something. He can smell this. You ever have people, we use the same word today, I smell a rat, you know. That was part of their teaching. And that the Messiah would know at once who was wicked and who was righteous. Because he's of quick understanding. In fact, there's a historical account, and I didn't get down where this came from, but one of the historical stories of Jewish history previous to that was... Now, understand, the Jews had seen a lot of messiahs come on the scene. People who claimed to be messiahs. One of them was a man named Bar Kokhba. And they said, Bar Kokhba reigned 2.5 years, and he said to the rabbis, I am the Messiah. They replied to him, it is written of the Messiah, Isaiah 11:3, that he smells or is of quick understanding and judges. So he smells a man and he knows what he is. And he said, let us see whether he smells and judges. And when they saw he did not smell and judge, they killed him. So if you're claiming to be a Messiah, you better have whatever test was going to be thrown at you, you'd better pass it real quick. So here was Jesus. Here's this woman. Here's the Pharisee with this cultural history saying, he doesn't get it. He doesn't see who she is. A Messiah, a prophet, would be able to smell this out real quick. And so he rejected. So, here's Simon making an assumption very quickly. It was a wrong assumption. It was a wrong assumption, but he assumed that his assumption was right, as humans tend to do. Now, what we're going to find is Jesus could sniff things out. He already knew who she was. He's going to mention this later. He knew she was a sinner. That wasn't his point. But to Simon it was. This was a problem for Simon. Because you see, for the Pharisees, to touch such a sinner would defile you. You were not allowed, they would go out of their way. They would cross the street to not touch somebody who was unclean. And so it says, when it says at the end of verse 39, he should know who she is, for she is a sinner. She is a sinner. So he had it all figured out. But instead of questioning his thinking, instead of questioning his own thinking, he defaulted to his thinking as a human will. My thinking's right. And so that's where he defaulted to. And he ignored the greater lesson. You know, brethren, Christ has called us to change our thinking. God has called us to change the thinking that humans are engaged in. And so he concludes the wrong thing. This woman is a vile person. He should have rejected her. Now, Jesus smelled all right. Jesus smelled all right. And he smelled the Pharisee. And so he was going to have to deal with that. He read his mind. It said that, Simon didn't speak this aloud. It said he spoke to himself. But Christ read his mind. And Jesus answered in verse 40 and said, Simon, I have something to say to you. He said, teacher, say it. Now, before we go any further, I'd like to stop here because we're about to enter a part of the discussion that has to do with judgment. There was judgment going on already. Simon was judging some things. Christ was judging some things. The woman was actually judging some things. It's amazing, though, how we judge. And before we go any further, let's consider 1 Corinthians chapter 11. 1 Corinthians 11. We were told something very important about judging. As it gives instructions about preparing for Passover, Paul wrote to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 11, 27, therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. It's not that we are worthy, but we're not to do it in an unworthy manner. How do we do this in a proper manner then? Verse 28. But let a man examine himself, and let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner, that is, without examining himself, eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this reason many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. And here's a lesson. For if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. But when we are judged, we are chastened by the Lord, that we may not be condemned with the world. There's a lot in this. Very important. If we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. Because when we judge ourselves, something happens. We see things. We tend to have our minds set on a course of self-correction. Not just by ourselves, of course, but with the help of God. We should never enter this without doing it with God. We should always enter the judgment of ourselves with God, asking for Him to help us, going to God and saying, what is it that you want to say to me? What do I need to see? What do you want me to understand about my life? Show me. That's throughout the Bible. But if we know that we're going to be chastened, it takes faith. It takes confidence in God. It takes love. It takes love to go to your father and say, "Would you show me? Would you show me what I need to do?" It takes faith, it takes confidence, it takes love to open yourself up to God. But that is exactly what we need. Now, if you've ever done this, you know that, okay, God will answer. God's going to show me something, and it's going to be for my good, but you're almost braced a little bit. I wonder what I'm going to learn. It's a good thing. We grow by it. But you always are thinking, okay, you know, what will it be? The Pharisee wasn't worried. Christ said to him, I need to say something to you. You know, when we are judging ourselves, that's us going to God. When we judge ourselves and we do it rightly, we will be going to God saying, "Talk to me, show me, teach me." And we will do so with that trembling heart in the right way. But the Pharisee wasn't worried. Christ said, "I have something to say to you. So speak on. Speak on. Tell me what you got." He didn't have a clue what was coming. He did not have a clue. And he didn't have a clue who he was dealing with. So we come to verse 41. And Jesus says, "There was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more?" Not a trick question necessarily. Now, they both have nothing to pay. They're bankrupt. It doesn't matter what the debt is when you have nothing to pay back. Whether you owe 50 or 500, you're in the same boat together. Both are insolvent. Nothing that can be done. So he forgives them both. Now, there's a principle in here about all of us. When it comes to the point of God extending his forgiveness to us, whether we have 500 sins or 50 sins, whatever it is that's accumulated, we can't pay him back. We have nothing with which we can't come and say, "Well, I'll pitch in, you know, I'll do 20 extra hours of public service this week. I'll pitch in another extra $5 in the offering, you know, and that'll get me through." No, I mean, what can we give? David went through that. He said, "I could offer bulls and goats and it wouldn't do it. Just what can I give back for the life?" And so it's a point of understanding. He forgives them both. He forgives them both. It's not that some sins are worse than other sins, and that our standing with God differs because of the person who has lesser or more sins than another. We're not into spiritual scorekeeping, neither is God. He was making a point about love, is what he was making the point. Who will love him the most? So, we come to, where are we, verse 43. Simon answered and said, "I suppose the one whom he forgave more." And he said to him, "You have rightly judged." Now Jesus' response was, you're right. Simon was already smug in his approach. And what Christ said probably made him feel pretty good. He was smug already, and now he's confirmed as being smart. Figured it out. It wasn't a real complicated question, but, you know, he figured it out. "I suppose" is sort of an intellectual answer. This was not getting to his heart. This was not convicting him. And he was right, technically, but he wasn't connecting the dots. Now, Christ had asked, "Which one will love him the most?" Do you think at this point it was dawning on Simon to examine himself about love? Do you think Simon saw himself as a loving person? Pharisees were religious. They knew that love is one of the cornerstones, one of the pillars of righteousness. Do you think he saw himself as a loving person? Undoubtedly. I mean, he was giving. Look, he invited you to dinner. That's love. Isn't it? Well, to what degree did he love? To what degree did he love? However he saw himself, the bubble was about to burst. And Jesus was about to look at this woman, and then he was about to have the gall to tell the host who had invited him to compare himself to the woman. And he was going to do it in front of his friends and all the guests there. And Simon wasn't going to come out too well. Why would Jesus do that? Was he trying to just put him in his place? Or was he really trying to help Simon understand something? What was he trying to do? Christ himself said that he did not come to condemn the world. He was trying to help people all of the time. He was trying to reach people. But some, it's more difficult to reach than others. It's more difficult to reach some people than others. So in verse 44, he turned to the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman?" Of course he saw her. He was talking about her. He said, "Take a look at her, Simon. I want you to see something. I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet. But she has washed my feet with her tears." That had to be impressive even to a Pharisee. "She washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss. But this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet. My feet. Since the time I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my head with fragrant oil." Now, at that time, when a guest entered the home, three things were always done. The host placed his hand on the guest's shoulder and gave him a kiss of peace. That was a mark of respect for a guest. Simon hadn't done that. He'd invited Jesus, but he hadn't even shown him that level of respect. The second thing, the people there, they didn't have roads like we have. They were dust. They came in a home. They took the sandals off, and water was poured over their feet to cleanse them and to clean them and to, just to be a nice, fresh, freshening thing. He didn't do that. Usually, a drop of perfume, often an attar of roses, was dropped on the person's head. These were things that common courtesy and good manners were the rule of the day. And in this case, not one of them was done. Simon was not even apparently conscious of the need to do this for Christ. And therefore, he felt no love. It just wasn't there. Simon's impression of himself was he was a good man. I'm a good man in the sight of God, in the sight of other people. So why did the woman feel a need to do it? He didn't feel a need to do it. Why did she feel a need to do this? What was on her mind? And why did Simon feel no need to do these things? What was her need? What was her need? It's very clear, it's already been mentioned, forgiveness. This is what Jesus addressed. What was she saying? As she was crying there, as she was weeping, was she muttering anything under her breath that Jesus could hear, or maybe others could hear? It doesn't tell us. It just doesn't tell us. It's not recorded. Was she saying, "Please forgive me. I've done some horrible things"? I don't know. Could have been. But whatever it was, she saw her need for forgiveness. And she was overwhelmed with love for the person who could give it. For the one who could give it. Whatever had gone on before, she recognized in him, whatever she had heard whatever she had seen, she recognized something in him, that she loved him deeply enough that she could come to him and expect that she would be forgiven. The Pharisee was self-sufficient. He didn't need anything from Christ. He didn't need anything. He did not see his need. There's one thing that will shut a human being off from God quicker than anything else, and that's being self-sufficient. Christ said, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." If we don't need that bread, we won't live by it. He said, "I am the bread of life." It was so important. In verse 47, Jesus said, "Therefore I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much." He makes a statement about her. It makes two different types of statements here. One is particularly about her. Her sins are forgiven. Now, why? Why would he forgive her sins? Beside the fact that she came for that and was asking for it, that showed something. Now, Simon could be sitting there and watching this and be saying, "Okay, now I get it. Now I see how you're operating this. Somebody curries a little favor with you, you forgive their sins. They come and they cry. They do something for you. They sprinkle some expensive perfume on you. That's why you forgave her. That's why you forgave her, isn't it?" Brethren, is that why God forgives people? Because we do something for Him? Can we curry favor with Him? And that's what happens. It doesn't tell us what was going on, but it would have been very easy for Simon to draw those conclusions. And Christ was making a point. No, her expression of love is not what caused me to forgive her. It's a result of being forgiven. For can mean therefore. She loved much. And then he makes the statement based on principle. He makes a statement about her specifically, and then he makes a statement about principle. To whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. The same loves little. He is making a statement here, a law of life that has to do with our relationship with God. It's an amazing thing that happens when we have this going on. The lesson is that love flows from forgiveness. The capacity to love in our lives, the learning to love God. It's affected by many things, but this is concrete. This is right at the foundation. When we understand forgiveness, when we understand what it took to be forgiven, when we value that forgiveness, when we comprehend the enormity of it, and we really see it, there is a response in a human being. That's not something you just take lightly and say, "Hey, thanks," and walk away. It is something that generates a response in somebody who really understands it. She got it. She got it. She understood it. In verse 50, he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." Your faith. It wasn't that she was just weeping. She came with faith. She believed something that she saw. She believed that this was the one who had the capacity to forgive her, that he would forgive her. What would it take for a woman who was a notorious sinner to come to a human being to say, "I believe that he can and that he will, and he has the godly authority to do that"? What would it mean for someone like that? She knew in advance. She knew in advance, and she had that faith. She came to him in faith. And it was done, and he said, "Go in peace." That was a tremendous statement for her, and undoubtedly she would have peace. Peace of mind. The peace of mind that comes from the time that you were dipped in the water at baptism and pulled up, and we were able to tell you, by the authority of Jesus Christ, your sins have been forgiven. What a peace. What a peace that brings. What a peace at the end of the Passover every year, when we have done the foot washing, taken the bread and the wine, and you leave there, and it's not joy that's like everybody's laughing and backslapping and having a big party, but it's that deep inner joy. It's that deep inner peace that comes from knowing where you are with God. She got it. She got it. It's a wonderful thing. The lesson is very clear in this section. The lesson is clear. There must be a concept of sin. There must be a concept of forgiveness. What, how, who, when, how that all works. There must be a concept then that our love deepens as a result. Forgiveness is an act of love. Forgiveness itself is an act of love. It's the greatest love. And she saw the enormity of her sin. Christ said, her sins are many. He saw that. She saw that. Now, it wasn't just the quantity, but it was the impact. It was the enormity. The enormity of it. Consider the situation. Which is worse? Which is the worst situation? To be a prostitute and to know that and to know what led you there and know your sin and be disgusted by the sin and be looking for a way out? Or is it worse to be self-righteous and not know your sin and not be disgusted by it and in fact simply be judgmental of everybody else in life? Which is harder to help somebody see? Which is harder to deal with? You know, it's a bad situation for her to be in, but it was tougher for Christ to work with Simon. It was harder for him to get through to Simon. Don't you understand love? Don't you understand where you're at? He simply could not get through. So, she had a deep sense of where she was and a deep faith that Christ could forgive her. And a prerequisite for forgiveness is repentance. So she had come to that point. And as a result, she poured out her expression of love for him. Forgiveness is the cause. Love is the effect. Now, there's a great contrast then in people who get it and people who don't. Her life was changing. Her life was changing tremendously. Simon's wasn't. Simon, there's no indication that his life was changing. His love for Christ was so little that Christ had really, he was asking him, were you really sincere at all in inviting me here? Even the common courtesies have not been extended. He was nice, he was cordial, he was friendly, but he did not genuinely love. And maybe that's because he saw no real sense of where he was and his position in regard to Christ. In 1 John 4 and verse 19, we read a simple statement. We love him because he first loved us. We love him because he first loved us. When we think about Colossians 3, in verse 14, above all, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. We are able to learn how to love God because he first loved us. We respond to him. Part of that love, the most powerful part and demonstration was that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. When we think about that at the Passover, what does that do for us then going into the days of unleavened bread? It makes us say, I want to be like that. That's how I want to be. That's my motivation. Because of what God has done for us. If I can have that same mind, that's the way I want to be. That is what is so important. She loved him because somehow she'd come to understand that he loved her. And he did. And he loved Simon too. Christ had come to die for her. And he'd also come to die for Simon. But they just didn't see it. And actually, Christ let her take care of washing his feet. But he himself Simon would not even allow her to touch him. That's how so different they were. Well, I can always adjust a little bit of what I was going to go through, and I think I will. I'll summarize just a bit now of what I was going to say. Let's go back to Luke chapter 7 and verse 48. Jesus said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." And once again, here are people looking at the same situation and drawing totally different conclusions. What this must have meant to the woman is so different from what it meant to some of the others. In verse 50, those who sat at the table with him began to say to themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" So you had different reactions going on. And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." So what does this mean for us? What does it mean for us? Well, it depends. Do we see ourselves in the woman, or do we see ourselves in Simon? If we see ourselves in the woman, it will mean a lot. It all depends on how we see sin and what that means to us. And I think we are all here because we see ourselves seeing sin, seeing forgiveness, understanding the love of God. And when he said, "Your faith has saved you," at the Passover tomorrow night, you will hear us say that participating in the Passover is an act of faith. We weren't there. We didn't see Christ, but we believe that he lived. We believe that he died. We believe that he died for us. We have faith that allows us to walk this way of life. And he said to her, "Go in peace." And it is in peace that we go. Go about our lives in that frame of mind. But not just peace to say, "Ah, oh, it's just a big relief." But the peace that comes from saying, "Now I live the way that Christ wants me to live. I strive to live that way." This is how our response should be. The woman got it. You wonder, what was on Simon's mind when he heard all this? It just ends at verse 50. Doesn't tell us what his thoughts were. Doesn't say anything. But you can see Christ was really trying to help him understand. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But he will someday. In the meantime, we see ourselves. And now it turns to back to our motivation. What motivates us? What do I want to do? What do I need to do? I don't have time to go through it, but I will give it for your reading. There were three occasions where women came and anointed Christ with oil, and another situation where his feet were washed again and dried with a woman's hair, Mary. These accounts, one of them was 6 days before he died, in John chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. You can read this later. John 12, 1 through 11. 2 days before he died, it happened again. Matthew 26, verses 1 through 13. And in both of those cases, it wasn't just a Pharisee that did not love. It was his disciples. He was criticized by them too for what was going on. "Why are you allowing them to spend this money on this oil?" And even Judas, in his hypocrisy, said, "Why, we could have taken this and given it to the poor." But it says he didn't say it because he loved the poor. He said it because he was a keeper of the bag. He kept the money. So not always did everybody see it. So three occasions of serving people serving Christ out of love. Many different reactions. But the example was, he's done something for us. What can we give in return to him? Now, we don't have Christ around to wash his feet anymore, do we? In one of those cases, no, actually in both of those cases, when he was criticized, Jesus said, "You don't always have me with you, but you always have the poor. You always have somebody in need." So if he's not around to take care of washing his feet, what does he tell us to do? He tells us to show our love for him by the way we treat others. There are others who are poor. And it's not just financially. In fact, in this country, it's usually not financially. But it may be poor in spirit, poor in needing encouragement, poor needing time, poor needing care, poor needing attention. How many people in this world need love? Need to be loved a little bit. The days of unleavened bread are all about becoming like Him. Being as He is. Putting on, as we read in Colossians 3. Putting on these qualities. We keep the Passover first. So we look to Him and see what He did. And then we go immediately into the days of unleavened bread that says, now what do we do? How do we behave? How do we act? Let's close with First John. Two statements here, two sections in First John. In chapter 3, 1 John 3, verse 16, says, by this we know love. How do we know love? He said, here it is. Because He laid down His life for us. That's how you know what real love is. And then He says, and we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. There's a response then, in turn, in kind. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. This is the motivation, because He laid down His life for us. This is what really begins to change the heart. And in verse 18, that gives us serious thought for the days of unleavened bread. What can I do now to increase my love? For that's not in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Love for God, love for fellow man. In chapter 4, in verse 7, He said, beloved, let us love one another. For love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. And this is the love of God. In this, the love of God was manifested toward us, that God has sent His only begotten Son into the world that we might live through Him. In this is love, not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, and He repeats it again, we also ought to love one another. Well, what the days of unleavened bread are designed to do is to help us map out our lives and to think, okay, how can I more efficiently live the way that would be God in me? What can I do toward God and what can I do toward others? How can I grow in the love of God? It begins with the Passover, and the Passover begins with the foot washing. Right there. You know, God is directing our minds. Now, I've told you already, there were three examples of people washing, well, two washing His feet and one anointing His head with oil. What we've not looked at, though, we've talked about the expression of love toward Christ, but what we've not looked at is that Christ also washed people's feet, too. His feet were washed, and He washed others. And we've got that account. We'll read that tomorrow night. He washed others' feet and He said, you do the same. You do the same. Well, even at the foot washing, we can do it in the way that the woman did or the way that Simon did. We can go through the same event, but people see it different ways. That's why it's important, even as we go there, to think in those terms of what does God want me to think? What does He want me to see? What does He want me to understand? When my wife was baptized, her first Passover was at Big Sandy at Ambassador College. You know, like 1,000 people in this big building. It's a huge setup. I mean, you had to set up rows and rows of chairs, and it had to be highly organized to get it done. And she was so excited, her first Passover. Walked down the line to sit in a chair, and there was a lady there who looked at her. She'd never seen this lady before. And this lady said, are you a student? She goes, yes. She said, I don't wash students' feet. She left. Walked off, and my wife is sitting there, you know, just stunned. I don't wash students' feet. And how, you know, it was just staggering that something like that would happen. Don't know what happened. Don't know what caused it. But the point was missed. The whole point was missed. I've known of people who want to make sure, well, I want to be with my friends, so I wash my friends' feet. Can miss the point. Can totally miss the point. You know, the best thing to do before Passover is to ask God, put me with the right person, that either for me I learned something, or maybe for them they learned something. I just want to be with the right person. And, you know, you learn that over the years, and sometimes you just never know. This came home really strongly to me a couple of years ago. We were in Barbados, and there were probably 60 members there, about 75 or 80, but for the Passover, there were probably 60 people. I didn't know any of these people, and in the whole church, there were like three or four white people. Most of the congregation there is black. And I got in line, washed the feet of this individual, went through with the rest of the Passover. On the holy day, he comes up to me, and he says, I need to tell you something that's been on my mind since the foot washing. He said, I've had a lot of anger over the years. And he said, it's racial anger. He said, I have been prejudiced. And he said, I could probably be called a racist for the anger that I have had for how I've been treated. And he said, when we were at the foot washing, and I was sitting there in that chair watching a white man wash my feet, he said, I just felt it lift. He said, it left me. And he said, it was a profound thing that God gave me. He said, I've never had it before, but to wash and to have my feet washed by the color of skin that I've had trouble with. He said, it was something God had for me to do. How do you know that? Nobody could know that going ahead. He didn't have to tell me that either. It had nothing to do with who I was or why I was there. It was what that man needed at the time. And it had a profound spiritual effect on him. So, you know, brethren, this whole thing of love and motivation is huge. We've just scratched the surface on it. But I hope that we can go into the Days of Unleavened Bread thinking about this. Matthew 24 said, because iniquity will abound, the love of many people will grow cold. And in a world that's going cold, we're not going to learn how to love from the world around us. We learn to love from God. We learn to love by looking at God, what He has done for us, what He is going to do for us, and the understanding that comes from the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. That's where we begin to love. That's where we begin to have our motivation. So whatever it is that you want to overcome and change, and whatever it is that you would like to have this feast work in your life to change you, just make sure that the foundational motive is love for God. Love for God, that'll translate into love for our fellow man, love for one another. And then the sense of forgiveness and how deep that runs, and the response to what has been done for us, will then help the love of God to follow in our lives.